Thanks for listening to Pop Culture Happy Hour. If you are looking for something new to listen to, there are lots of other NPR podcasts, including great interviews, highlights from the week's news, storytelling, and entertainment. Browse them all on iTunes under podcasts. And that's the kicky music that means it is time again for Pop Culture Happy Hour. I'm Linda Holmes. I'm the editor of NPR's pop culture and entertainment blog, Monkey See. On this week's show, we'll look at the intriguing new science fiction film, Edge of Tomorrow. We'll ask what it has to say about time travel, what it has to say about Tom Cruise, and whether any of us would survive 1 minute in an encounter with Emily Blunt. Then we'll pivot to the matter of noble failures. How are they noble? How are they failures? How do they happen? And how long does it take for them to be recognized? As always, we will close the show with what's making us happy this week. Before we get started here in historic Studio 44, let's go around the table. Stephen Thompson, what do you do at NPR?
I am a writer and editor with NPR Music.
And Glenn Weldon, what do you do at NPR?
I write about books and comic books for the NPR website.
And Chris Klimek is with us this week. Sometimes Chris writes for NPR. What else do you do, Chris?
I write about movies for The Dissolve. I write about theater for the Washington City paper. And by the time you're hearing this, my first urban transit story will be up at Atlantic Cities.
So this is very exciting. We will link to that for Chris so that you can see Chris's first urban transit story at Atlantic Cities. Now, before we get started on this week's show, we will be talking about Edge of Tomorrow and we will be talking about noble failures. But first, it is Monday morning and we should acknowledge that last night there were the Tony Awards, which we have sometimes in the past spent a lot of time talking about. Mm. We are just going to touch on them briefly this year. They were hosted by Hugh Jackman instead of recent running host Neil Patrick Harris. And I thought they were kind of boring. Glenn, would you care to comment?
Yeah, the word you used on the blog is fizzled. I get that. Boy, Hugh Jackman is game, you know?
Yeah.
He throws himself into it. Good for him. Bless his heart. And he spent a lot more time on screen than I think Patrick Harris has done in recently because, there are certain segments where he was singing the category, which really puts him front and center. But, I think he fizzled.
Yeah, I think he struggled a little bit. What did you think, Thompson?
I felt a little bit like, particularly from the opening bit on, they were in the shadow of last year's Tony's telecast.
I agree.
Which I think everybody agrees was fantastic. And you had that wonderful, amazing Neil Patrick Harris opening number that we've referenced on this show multiple times. And in this, they didn't try to duplicate that. So they just had Hugh Jackman hopping.
Right.
Through the facility.
In an homage to a Bobby Van number from a movie called Small Town Girl, which I don't think anybody saw, but which many people have seen in the compilation That's Entertainment Part 2.
Exactly.
Well, there you go. So he's hopping around, primarily for me raising the question of whether he's going to whang his head on an exit sign.
Right.
That, to me, when that's kind of the most impressive bit of choreography in the bit, though, is how did he keep from conking his head?
Right.
I mean, the Tonys are always a little bit of a tricky sell. I'm not big on musical numbers and awards shows. And this is kind of the awards show if all you want to see is musical numbers and speeches.
Right. Agreed. What did you think, Chris? Did you watch it?
I was in and out a little bit. I admired Hugh Jackman's beard very much. I think that's as much a structural feat of hair engineering as the Wolverine hairstyle.
Nice, sure. Yeah.
Audra McDonald's acceptance speech was very moving. The only one of the shows that I saw that was up for anything this year was If Then, when it did its tryout pre-Broadway here at the National Theater in D.C., and I did not like it very much.
Yeah, I hadn't seen anything this year except Cripple of Inishman with Daniel Radcliffe, which I really, really enjoyed quite a lot. But I do think that, as Stephen said, I think they were in the shadow of last year's broadcast a little bit. There were big wins for Bryan Cranston playing LBJ in All the Way, which also won for Best Play. Big win for A Gentleman's Guide to Love and Murder, which I believe Trey Graham talked about on this show quite a while ago before it was cool, as they say. And, big wins for other people.
Big win for Hedwig.
Win for Hedwig. Best revival of a musical, and Neil Patrick Harris won.
And Lena Hall as the featured actress in a musical. And, God bless her. That was a really very cute, very sincere speech. She also, at one point, says, "Without all of you, there would be no me," which should have been inscribed above the doorway of every high school drama department.
It's a good point.
It's a good thing to say to your parents.
And Jesse Mueller, who does an uncanny Carol King.
Boy, I liked her voice a lot.
Well, she sounds so much like Carol King. She plays Carole King in a musical called Beautiful, which is kind of the Carole King story. And Jesse Mueller has a very, very good Carole King voice.
Is this a lasting treasure or just a moment's pleasure? Can I believe the magic of your sight? Will you still love me tomorrow?
Enough that it's not distracting, which is what you want right. from performances of Carole King songs. But overall, yeah, it was a little lukewarm.
I always find when I watch the Tony Awards, because I'm not super plugged into to what is highly acclaimed on Broadway, I do have this process every year of like, what 20-year-old movie has been revived? For? So it was Aladdin and Bullets Over Broadway. Yep. And I'm like, my dream of a Three Men and a Baby... musical.
Closer and closer.
Waterworld is next year. Waterworld. 2015 is the 20th anniversary.
How did we miss out on a Working Girl musical? Has there been a Working Girl musical?
I thought there was.
I'm not sure.
They're doing Hocus Pocus.
But your dream of a Three Men and a Baby musical, whether it happens or not, is in no way out of the realm of possibility.
Yeah.
Quick, one more quick thing, quick reaction.
He's a music man.
He's a what?
He's a music man, and he sells clarinets to the kids in the town with the big trombones and the rat-a-tat drums and the big brass bass, big brass bass.
Stephen, how did you feel about the LL Cool J, T.I., Hugh Jackman rapping Music Man?
That's your answer.
Silence. Dead silence.
Was your answer. It was...
interesting.
They were game. Glenn said they were game.
I gotcha. Yeah. How about you, Glenn?
Same. I had no words. None.
Did you have any words, Chris? Did you see it?
I did not see that part.
Yeah, I have to admit, I sort of fell into the realm of Mark Harris, a critic I like a lot, who tweeted, essentially, it got over for me with the enthusiasm and the gameness, and it was kind of cool and interesting. It was set up by Questlove, and you should watch it online, and we'll try to provide a link to it. Anyway, so those were the Tonys. We thought they were kind of dull. But now you know some of the winners and losers. And speaking of winners and losers, this weekend, Edge of Tomorrow, the sci-fi movie starring Tom Cruise, did not make a tremendous amount of money, it is safe to say. It made a little under $29 million in its opening weekend, which sounds pretty good until you realize that it cost upwards of $175 million to make.
Mm-hmm.
So in Edge of Tomorrow, Tom Cruise plays a military guy who is sort of winds up as part of a multinational force fighting aliens. And he discovers at one point, and this is all in the premise, I don't think this is terribly spoilery, it is the reason why the movie is called what it is called. He does discover at one point that he is living the same day over and over again, and that every time he dies, he resets. It's not so much living the same day as it is he goes back to the same time point every time he dies, he comes back to life. And he eventually meets a lady fighter played by Emily Blunt, who you may know from a variety of other roles, and they have to fight the aliens. What did you think of the movie, Chris?
I really, really liked it. I'm going to borrow the words of Matt Singer when he wrote about this on The Dissolve this morning. America, this is why we cannot have nice things.
Mm-hmm.
When you say you want an original, I mean, I know this is based on a Japanese novella with illustrations, not a graphic novel, but something that's a pretty fresh piece of material to most viewers who are going to see it, not based on a comic book, not based on an old TV show, has an intriguing premise. Even Groundhog Day, the one movie that everyone is using as their ready point of comparison, is 21 years old at this point.
Hey, there should be a Groundhog Day musical.
I'm sure it's happening. I really like this movie. It is upsetting to me that this movie opens with less than a third of the opening weekend gross of that idiotic sixth Fast and Furious movie that we saw together about this time last year.
We certainly did. How about you, Glenn?
Yeah, I'm going to contribute to the word of mouth. I love this. This was a lot of fun. Its premise, which is that Tom Cruise is caught in a time loop, means that its pacing can slow and expand as much as it wants to. And, you know, there's always, in a high-concept movie like this, there's always a lag. The audience clicks into what's going on immediately, takes the protagonist a little bit of time, and then the protagonist has to explain to other people and say, now, I know this sounds crazy. And so there's a part in this movie where somebody actually does say, how is that even possible? And you're like, up, 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 up. Wrong question. You're asking the wrong question. Let's move it along. And this movie moves that along. And it gives Tom Cruise more to do than he usually gets. He goes from being a coward to a soldier. And he lunges at it. Now, my critique of Tom Cruise is that he lunges at pretty much everything.
Yeah.
There's not a lot of modulation there. But we can talk a little bit more about him. But I really dug this film. It was great to see Emily Blunt use her own accent. And every time I saw her on screen being a badass, I thought back to her being a different kind of badass in Devil Wears Prada.
Yeah.
And just seeing those two, having those two performances in your head together was great. She is fantastic.
She really is. What did you think, Thompson?
I loved this movie. I just got a gigantic kick out of it. Like, it was, for me, a reminder, and clearly, I must be part of the problem, because this didn't do well. But this is exactly what I want from Big Summer blockbustery movies. This is a big effects-laden movie. There's a ton of CGI in it. It's explodey and loud. It's basically a war movie.
Right. But it's not grim. There are jokes.
It is. There's not only are there jokes, but there's wit in the pacing.
Yeah,
The way that David Edelstein, I think it was, put it in his review was that the writers know where to put the ellipses, which I thought was very, very well expressed.
They used what might seem like a weakness, which is this constantly having to loop back and show you some of the same things over and over again. They use that as a strength and craft jokes around it. I did find the ending, and I'm not going to give anything away, but I found the ending somewhat unsatisfying. They sort of, when you have to wind that kind of thing to a conclusion, you are bound to come to some fairly pat and simple and simplistic conclusions. But I just found, like, huge swaths of this movie enormously clever and entertaining. I enjoyed Tom Cruise in it. I don't have quite the knee-jerk anti-Tom Cruise mentality that a lot of people are expected to have, but I just got a gigantic kick out of it.
I agree with you about the ending, actually, and that was really the only part that let me down a little bit, and I kept thinking, like, what if somebody like Chris Nolan had made this movie? Because I think he's about the only person...
It wouldn't have been funny.
Well, that's true. That's true. But Doug Liman made Mr. and Mrs. Smith and Swingers and a lot of funny stuff. You know, but I'm thinking as far as people who can get away with something really kind of subversive at that budget level, you know, he might be the only one.
It should not surprise you that the novel, the original Japanese, what they call a light novel, what we would call YA, the original novel, which has an even worse title, I would argue, than Edge of Tomorrow.
Which is saying something.
I think All You Need Is Kill is better.
I disagree. I disagree strongly. Has a different ending. A much more interesting ending. I'll just put it that way. We won't spoil it, but I mean, it's worth reading. It will take you no time at all.
Yeah.
And it has a less Hollywood ending, put it that way.
I was concerned about seeing this. I was concerned about seeing this for the show because I think after Godzilla, after we did not care for Godzilla, we did have some conversations with listeners and commenters and stuff like that along the lines of, do you just hate blockbusters? Which I think is a very fair question to ask yourself periodically. And, you know, we had some conversations at the beginning of the summer, candidly, about trying not to go to every single giant summer movie for exactly that reason, that if you feel fatigued on giant summer movies, you have to be a little bit discriminating. We did not go to the second Spider-Man movie. We did not go to the X-Men movie, partly because Glenn wasn't here. We have been sort of spacing them out. So when I went to see this movie, I was a little concerned because I sort of thought, if I hate this movie, especially if I'm the only one who doesn't like it, I'm going to feel like I'm a little butterfly pinned to a foam board in a box, and everybody's going to then just sit there, and I'm mixing my metaphors, throw darts at me. So
I feel like that one really got away from me.
I'm diagramming it. I'm almost done. Hang on. Processing.
So my point is, I really liked it too, and I was really relieved to really like it because I would never say I liked it if I didn't, but I really genuinely liked it. I think exactly what Steven said is what I was going to say, that there's wit in the pacing. There's wit in the editing, which is, I think, one of the reasons I tend to notice wit in editing is that one of the forms that is most commonly possessed of witty editing is reality shows, to be honest. Mm-hmm. The hard cut from one thing to something else. Mm-hmm. And this movie makes some good use of that. But I think, as Chris said about the Edelstein review, that idea of knowing where to put the ellipses, like, I think that idea of being able to figure out exactly how long you show the repeat and how much you vary it, and then you scoot back to where people want to be, I think they have an uncanny sense of how to do that. I did want to mention the editor is a guy named James Herbert, who also edited the Sherlock Holmes movies with Robert Downey Jr., I think has done some of this kind of like funny action stuff. I think the editing is excellent. I think the directing is excellent. And, you know, the only thing that I have a knee-jerk reaction to regarding Tom Cruise is that, unfortunately, a long time ago, someone pointed out to me that his front teeth are one half tooth over to the side so that directly under like the middle of his nose is the middle of a tooth. And I get so distracted looking at the tooth. But other than that, I have no knee-jerk reaction.
Did you see this film in IMAX?
But what I'm saying is I do think he's been through a lot as far as public perception. There's been tons of personal stuff. But when you think back to the beginning of that guy's career, he was really fun to watch in movies. I'm not so much talking about the Top Gun phase, which is just wonderful, blown out movie star stuff. When he was in Risky Business and when he was in some of these other movies, like even the comedy that's in A Few Good Men and things like that, he is so much better. He's like Hugh Grant in this way. He's so much better when there's a little bit of weaseliness the character that he's playing as opposed to the kind of grand athletic hero. And the first scene that he plays in this movie where he's explaining that he is not a soldier, he is a PR guy, basically, I think is a terrific scene. And I think it is him playing directly into his strongest kind of area of performance. So I enjoyed it a lot. And I agree with you. I think Emily Blunt is wonderful in it.
The fact that they make him a coward in the beginning of this movie, I think is a very, very clever touch. For one thing, we've seen a million movie star heroes in a million of these movies. And that thing of like forcing a normal person into a situation where that person has to do extraordinary things. And in this case, because the day is constantly looping and he has infinite, seemingly infinite numbers of opportunities to get it right, he is only able to be heroic by rote.
Right.
And by complete necessity. And I think that's such a clever box to put that guy in.
Absolutely. Because when we see Tom Cruise on screen, we're not seeing him just in that role. We're seeing every Tom Cruise movie we've ever seen playing the action star. And to see him have to do a little bit more, and then as the film progresses, get more and more recognizable to our subconscious, becoming more and more that guy, is a really, as you say, it's a really smart way to do it. There was an interview with Tom Cruise, an hour-long interview on the Nerdist podcast last week, and I have never heard Tom Cruise speak for more than two minutes at a time.
I was going to say, I'm going to have to listen to that.
You will learn nothing about him, because I really do believe there's nothing there. He has this persona, this facade. You can sort of explain it away because, I mean, I have a couple of theories. One is because what he does on this podcast, which is a bunch of comedians joking around riffing and then the guest going back and forth, you know, they've had people on the show who are not funny, who are not witty, but they still join in some way. And his definition of joining in is to repeat the joke that was just said by somebody else as if that's contributing. And he does it over and over again. It's fascinating. And my theory is, you know, he talks a little bit about how when he was growing up, he went to a lot of different schools, a lot of different towns. If that's your life, you kind of develop a shell, an ingratiating quality. And that's what I really get when you look him in the eyes and on screen, this hunger to be accepted.
Yeah. Oh, yeah, yeah, yeah.
This dude has nothing inside, but when you plug him into something like this, he goes. And he's basically like an existential void with good hair.
And the way you can tell, actually, the tooth.
That's it. Well, there's something off.
The thing is, I don't need you to be funny on podcasts. As popular as it is now to be a guy who's great on Jimmy Fallon, and he was funny on Jimmy Fallon. He broke eggs on his head. It was funny. But as much as people want you to be great on podcasts, great in interviews, great when you kind of do behind the scenes extras, whatever, he is a great example of where if you are good and if you are fun to watch in movies, as long as I don't think you are a malicious monster, I can very much be like, I have no idea what this guy's deal is as a human being, but I enjoy him in movies, which is how I am with him when he's in the right thing.
Yeah, I mean, I have exactly that same impression of him as that Glenn just described. I feel that way about Beyonce, too, where I feel like as soon as the cameras are gone, she just like plugs back
mail.
Into. I know. I have seen Beyonce live.
Mail.
Yeah, I saw Beyonce and Pink within about a month of each other and was just struck by how much more human and spontaneous and unrehearsed Pink seemed. I liked that she didn't mind that we were seeing her sweat on stage, where Beyonce had like 8 costume changes in a 90-minute show and a lot of pre-recorded video and stuff. I mean, I feel that way about Tom Cruise too, and I think this movie, I don't know the history of this script kicking around. I don't know if it was developed for him or what, but I think it is, you know, an incredibly astute casting choice that this sort of melds the the cocky, callow Tom Cruise of Top Gun and A Few Good Men and Rain Man, for which William Goldman said that he deserved the Oscar, not Dustin
and
Hoffman.
I've said that too. Me and William Goldman.
I agree, talking about it the other day.
I agree with that. I think he's actually a pretty good actor. I think he's just as Glenn is saying, a hard dude to get a feel for from a human perspective.
Yeah, and I like him in the sort of turned off action roles that he seems increasingly reliant on in the last 10 years. I mean, as far as like blank slate kind of Terminator type superheroes goes, he's my favorite one.
Yeah.
But in Edge of Tomorrow, it like makes sense that he becomes that way because he's done this 1,000 times already. So I thought that was very clever. I also thought that entire premise that we're going to, you know, repeat the events of this day over and over again was a really smart way to play on the blockbuster fatigue that people have been describing for the last few summers.
And it's not just playing on blockbuster fatigue, though for me it totally did. It also, as I think it was a Keith Phipps in The Dissolve pointed out, since it's mentioned The Dissolve Day, Keith had a great line about how it's like the best video game movie that's ever been made that is not an adaptation of a video game.
Yeah. Yeah.
That it is playing off the idea of this infinite number of lives and this constantly, you reset, you start over and reset and try again and try again and try again until your muscle memory is to the point where you can get to the big boss.
Right,
and
exactly.
I do want to say, I think the other thing that I want to make sure we mention is this really good performance from Emily Blunt.
Yeah.
I mean, there is sort of this sense that, yes, it is a hot dude and a hot lady, and there are little moments of being attracted to each other and stuff like that.
Wait a second. Because I've been thinking. I mean, this thing's in my blood. So maybe there's some way I can transfer it to you.
I've tried everything. It doesn't work.
I mean, have you, you know, tried all the options?
Oh, you mean sex? Yeah, tried it.
How many times?
All right.
But their relationship to me, mostly, for most of the movie, really is about a kind of a partnership and an affinity and a respect. And they find this weird way of striking a balance between the two of them, which is that she is much better at the thing that they are trying to do in terms of fighting and all that stuff than he is. She's trained. He's a dodo. But he has the advantage of living the day over and over again. There is this way that neither one of them seems to be dominant in the situation because he has an advantage and she has an advantage. And it's one of the few times I have ever seen a man and a woman in an action movie where one of them did not appear to be essentially running after the other one, having their hand held.
Sure.
I think she is terrific in this movie. I think the part is good. As Glenn was saying, I think having this and her really good work in The Devil Wears Prada sort of in your head at the same time, she deserves much better than some of the movies that she's wound up in. Mm-hmm. I think she's an incredibly interesting young actress. Yeah. As unlike a lot of really interesting young actresses, she does not wind up being glamorized in this movie really at all. I think they're very straightforward about, you know, she wears a big heavy suit a lot of the time. Incidentally, I love how bad he is at the suit at the beginning.
Yeah. But that repeated shot of her coming out of her yoga pose is pretty awesome.
That's
like, I can see why they, and I don't think that's a sexualized pose. I think it's more of a badass pose.
I think it's a combination of a graceful moment and a strength moment that I liked a lot.
Can I make one little side note watching this movie? This is a war movie, and it is a PG-13 movie. Kind of a side note separate from this film, but something that I'm finding every blockbuster I see, and part of what I think is feeding into my blockbuster fatigue, is the PG-13-iness of all of these movies, of all the bloodless carnage. This is a brutal war movie in which lots and lots of people are killed and killed and killed and killed.
Again, video gamey.
It's very video gamey, it brings to mind a recent little news item I saw where the movie Lucy, which stars Scarlett Johansson, it's directed by Luc Besson, and it's getting an R. And the fact that it's getting an R rating is news.
Mm-hmm.
That's a problem. To me, the movie rating system is nowhere is it more broken. Well, there are other areas, the weird prudishness of it is more broken.
Yeah.
But
not necessarily more broken.
But another area in which it is incredibly broken is that every damn movie has to be PG-13.
And therefore so, bloodless violence.
So I wrote a piece about this, about Captain America and the Raid for the blog, like a month or two ago.
I don't really read your work.
Or my blog.
It was on Linda's blog. that is kind of endemic, but I feel like in this movie, the combatants are afraid. You know, they're terrified, and that's kind of the difference. Whether you see any more blood or maimings or whatever than you do in the Avengers, where I feel like ends with 20 minutes of chaos, the way that this kind of begins, or, well, not quite begins, but has this, you know, this central invasion, like D-Day sequence, where it's 20 minutes, everybody's getting wiped out. you know, I feel like it's intentionally chaotic instead of just like Joss Whedon is a TV guy who doesn't really know what to do with massive screen full of pixels of things slamming into each other. But everyone's afraid. That's why the memory of what you've just seen lingers with you. Yeah. And it does give the violence more of a, it's more of a weight, I think, than like the Marvel superhero movies do.
Yeah. But we liked this movie a lot, as you can tell. And so come and find us on Facebook at facebook.com/PCHH or on the blog at npr.org/PCHH. And tell us what you think of this movie, what you think of blockbusters in general, and whether you have blockbuster fatigue. And we will be seeing a few more over the course of this summer. I'm sure that you will see some of them, too. And if you did skip Edge of Tomorrow, maybe try it out. Just saying. Maybe try it out. So the other topic we were going to talk about today may be related, maybe not related. One of the topics that we got from listeners during a recent call out that Stephen did on the Facebook page asking for ideas for topics was to talk about something that's called a noble failure. Now, the question is, what do we mean by noble failure? And one of the reasons that I'm going to start with Chris, because one of the reasons why we thought it would be really fun to have Chris on the show is that Chris is a big Hudson Hawk guy. And we know Chris is a big Hudson Hawk guy. And we wondered wondered how Chris would feel about the concept of the noble failure and whether or not his love of Hudson Hawk has anything to do with noble failures.
By the way, before Chris starts, I think Hudson Hawk, natural for a musical.
Yes, it is. Actually, the most memorable scene in Hudson Hawk for me is when the two cat burglars played by Danny Aiello and Bruce Willis, of course, rather than using a sophisticated piece of technology like, say, a stopwatch, mm-hmm. Casio digital watch, mm-hmm. to time their precisely worked out incursion and safe cracking operation, they sing a song, Swinging on a Star.
And all the monkeys on in the zoo, every day you see quite a few.
It's all up to you.
You could be better than you are. You could be swinging on a star.
Got the horse head?
Just got out of jail yesterday and I'm robbing an auction house.
Let's go, Hawk.
Respect yourself.
You got to me.
Chris, explain this film to me.
Seagrams.
It's a heist film. What is this movie?
Premise
is heist movie.
So we're looking at
he is this cat burglar who gets out of jail, and as soon as he's out, his parole officer is blackmailing him to take part in this international conspiracy to locate the pieces of an alchemy machine mm-hmm. invented by Leonardo da Vinci that he has disassembled and hidden in various of his artworks around the world. So in order to convert lead into gold, you have to, you know, go to all the places where they keep these masterpieces
and it's
and
generally
get the parts.
Yeah, okay. So the movie is generally considered to be a flop. Yes.
Grossed
critical
17
failure?
Million on a $65 million budget.
Nice.
Counts.
With the exception of a glowing review that I read on opening day in 1991 from Hal Hinson of the Washington Post, where he proclaimed, unironically, this hawk flies. I think its critical reputation is pretty bad, too.
So what do you like about it?
I just love the sort of incongruity of the stuff with the singing. The casting is completely bizarre. You have a pre-stardom, pre-annoying David Caruso in a silent role where he plays like sort of a mime assassin. You have James Coburn from In Like Flint playing a grizzled old CIA guy.
As he
you
does.
Have
the villains is where this movie
yes,
goes way
yes.
over the top.
Sandra Bernhard and Richard E. Grant. Uh-huh. More indie film faces, more avant-garde theater uh-huh. faces than blockbuster faces uh-huh. showing up in this Joel Silver mega budget vanity project for Bruce Willis based on a cocktail napkin idea that he and his buddy musician Robert Kraft came up with when they were working in bars together.
So let me ask you, if we were to say noble failure and you said yes, that would mean, it sounds like from this description,
because the failure is as read. We agree on the failure.
We can acknowledge failure.
Well, but that actually is an interesting question. Because failure, if we're defining failure as commercial failure, and we're just defining noble as being good, then there are a million things that are commercially unsuccessful that are good.
To me,
so I think you have to be talking about something else.
Yeah, well, I think the way it was pitched, it wasn't as noble failure, it was noble flop.
Oh, noble flop.
The distinction is flop is just widely, kind of universally perceived to have been a gigantic disaster.
Phantom Menace.
But I mean,
but that still made tons of money.
Right. Yeah. In this case, when I think of Hudson Hawk, I think it cost a fortune. Now, $65 million in 1991.
That's like 130 now. That's
right. Which is still fairly modest by today's proportions. Yeah. There are a lot of.
But I mean, you know, they weren't making movies for China, and you know, back then.
Right.
I mean,
This was a very big budget movie. It came out early in the summer.
It was supposed
to do very, very well, and it just went splat. And it went splat with great one-star review fanfare all over the place. And the fact that it had the ego trip behind it. Anytime you start to get this blood in the water, like it's way over budget, it's a vanity project for a star run amok, that kind of stuff turns these things from a mere cutthroat island, which is actually one of the biggest money-losing movies of all time. That's Rennie Harlan directing Gina Davis.
Right.
That movie cost way more than Hudson Hawk, and I think made way less.
Well, and
I think that's right.
We talked a while ago in a show about the concept of the fiasco.
Yeah.
And one of the things that we said about the fiasco was that there has to be some ambition, or it's not really worthy of being a fiasco. It's just bad.
Right.
So my question is, if you say noble/noble flop, how much of calling Hudson Hawk a noble flop is about ascribing that audaciousness that Chris is sort of...
I wrote down hubris.
Yeah.
Well, it's definitely guilty of hubris. I mean, this is Bruce Willis thinking that every idea he's ever had is great, you know, and he and Joel Silver were kind of in cahoots on this, where as long as he, you know, dangles the prospect of doing another Die Hard somewhere down the line, this is the summer after Die Hard 2, directed by Rennie Harlan.
And this is the same sense of him that you get from the book The Devil's Candy that I was talking about a couple weeks ago when he was doing Bonfire of the Vanities.
And I think
stage in his career.
I mean, Bruce Willis was very cocky in interviews and stuff at this point. You know, so Silver was like, yeah, Bruce, whatever you want. They actually hired Stephen E. D'Souza, who wrote Die Hard, to, you know, flesh out the cocktail napkin a little bit.
Yeah.
Just the notion that something TriStar Pictures, which I believe is defunct now, go figure, would fund something like this. It's not the product of a boardroom meeting, right? Or quarterly earnings report or something. You can't say it's not personal. It may not be to your taste.
That's my thing. It has to not be generic. That's exactly it. I mean, I wrote down, you know, not necessarily hubris or ambition, but there has to be an internal consistency of tone that sets it apart, that makes it clear that this
is
not
distinctive in some way.
Right. This is not a four quadrant thing that they might have had delusions that it might be. Mm-hmm. But, you know, when I think of this, I think of a movie like The Adventures of Buckaroo Banzai Across the Eighth Dimension, which almost goes in the opposite direction because you get the sense that it was preconceived to be a cult movie.
Right.
Like they went into it thinking, let's make this weird. And if that film were made today, one of the things about the film is that it pretends like there's this huge backstory. It's basically a riff on Doc Savage. So it pretends like this huge backstory around all these characters that it just presents as read. It expects you to fill it in. If that film were made today, there would be an online presence around it that you could just get lost in. But all they had back then was a novelization. But it does seem odd. It does seem defiantly weird. Another example is the Chris Elliott television show Get a Life. Mm-hmm. Again, if that were to happen today...
Well, they would do it on FX.
There'd be an FX. It would be an IFC. It would be on Adult Swim. There's a place for that. It's a very odd television show where he played a 30-year-old paperboy. It got very dark and very absurd in a way that television just didn't back then. It was exactly about itself. It knew exactly what it was. It's just that there was no place for it back then. So that's what I think of when I think of a noble failure and a noble flop.
Yeah, and I was thinking, you know, it's got to be more than something that turned out terrible that clearly has... Because the other way to think about noble is like a person who has what they consider a lofty goal. Because otherwise you wind up with a noble failure being something like this.
This is Fragile. This is the best Sting album. Nothing Like the Sun is the best Sting album.
Mm.
You're going to mock me for saying there's a best Sting album, but there is.
But what this is this is Sting.
This is the Portuguese version.
This is Sting performing Fragile in Portuguese, which sounds like a really cool idea, and I think in some ways is a really cool idea. I'm going to take a record that I released in English. I'm a really famous English language artist, and I'm going to release it in this language of kind of what it's influenced by, right? It's a cool idea. But when I listen to it, I just feel like, ooh, I have this weird reaction to it where I feel like you had an idea, I sort of respect, but when I actually listen to it, it kind of gets weird. Now, my other example is one that some of you will remember a little bit better. It was a movie from not so long ago, and it goes a little something like this.
Our lives and our choices, each encounter.
Luisa Rey, Spyglass Magazine.
Right. Suggests a new potential direction.
That's it. The music from my dream.
I call it the Cloud Atlas Sextet.
It's a very good example.
Some of you may remember Cloud Atlas, the film version of the David Mitchell novel, directed by the Wachowskis, talented directors, capable, imaginative, exciting people.
Sometimes reach vastly exceeds grasp.
And that is to me the noble failure, is when the reach exceeds the grasp. It's rare for me to be this bored in a movie and yet feel like I walk out holding nothing against anybody.
Right.
I understand that they were trying to get their arms around this novel, which is so interestingly structured and so thematically ambitious. And I walked out of that movie and I was like, I do not think that worked at all. Mm-hmm. I thought it was boring. I didn't care about it. But I'm glad they tried.
Good for you.
You didn't like it, but you admired it. I have that reaction to a lot of things.
It's so patronizing of me, but I feel like I'm glad you tried. It's so Minnesotan, you know, because I do have that feeling a little bit. And that to me is the ultimate noble failure idea, is this idea of reach that exceeds grasp, which is something we talked about with fiascos. But I think with noble failures, you're talking less about things that become kind of conspicuously awful,
right,
like a fiasco.
Right.
And this is where you just can't make
quieter.
It come to. Yeah, it's quieter.
Fiascos are
a fiasco.
Noisy.
Yeah.
Well, and for me, and I kept going back to money lost as a metric, and it's a very, very spotty metric for what we're talking about. I have a list here through an obscure little website called Wikipedia. Mm. All these metrics vary, but they listed, like, what are the movies that lost the most money ever? And actually, 47 Ronin, the Keanu Reeves movie, has lost apparently more money than any movie ever. And who even, remembers that movie happened.
That would explain why.
I remember the trailer for like a year.
Yeah.
And, like,
oh,
did
yeah.
it even come out?
Yeah. I feel like that movie just was a trailer. It came out late last year. And the list is this weird mix of like Mars Needs Moms, The 13th Warrior, some of these very stealth, Sahara, Final Fantasy, The Spirits Within. These are a lot of very kind of forgettable, kind of run-of-the-mill movies that they spent too much money on. And to me, the interesting ones that come up are the ones where for some reason they went colossally over budget. And I think that's part of what gets the sharks in the water talking about them as these big flops, your Heaven's Gate type movies. And there were several on the list that jumped out as, you know, you think about like Ishtar.
Right.
And you have these stories of why Ishtar cost so much money. The Lone Ranger is another example of just ludicrously expensive. Like, what, did they make their own trains or something?
Yes, they did.
And that movie lost just an insane amount of money. And that's part of why, I mean, there were Lone Ranger defenders while the Lone Ranger was in theaters.
Matt Zoller's Seitz loved it.
Seitz
like 3.5 stars.
Yeah.
And I think it's really interesting. And we talk a lot about how certain cycles have gotten shorter over time.
Right.
The defending maligned movies
Agreed.
Cycles have gotten
sure.
so short. And so I bring to you, I watched over the weekend to prepare for this segment, I watched a movie called John Carter.
Aha, uh-huh, which I have defended on this show before.
It's very interesting, the differing reactions. I watched it at home on my giant TV in HD with my kids. And my 13-year-old son lasted a half an hour before we paused it. And he said, Dad, can I go upstairs? This movie is so incredibly boring. Both kids were just surly and lost. And
more
just,
than you.
More than me. You know, I'm usually the one who's surly and lost.
Right.
That movie is $250 million of just expensive, clamorous exposition on top of exposition on top. It is this confusing muddle and this weird mix. A lot of these movies that we're talking about here are very strangely old-fashioned in some ways. You know, kind of like Cutthroat Island is trying to be this very old-fashioned swashbuckler.
Yeah.
In a way, this is kind of an old-fashioned...
I mean, trying to renew a genre that kind of went extinct for a reason seems to be a feature of
those
some
are ones that often come from love. Those are ones that often come from somebody remembering, I want to make a big desert movie. Like when you talk about Sahara, I want to make a big, like the ones
they remember from
my childhood. I want to make a pirate movie. I want to make a,
That's a great example. And John Carter is a very lovingly made
and that's
movie.
That's Andrew Stanton, right? He's a Pixar guy. He made Finding Nemo.
It's
and
his, everything
those,
from love.
Those
he
Pixar movies, I mean, they're so tight. You know, they're perfected at the script stage. So, I mean, it's baffling to me that this could have come from that
guy. Yeah, but see, the reason I defended it is because...
And you're not alone in defending
universally
it.
Universally panned. And I didn't understand why this movie was being singled out. The budget is why it was being singled out.
Yeah.
If this film hadn't cost as much as it did, this would have come and gone, and I
would
have enjoyed
would have developed a cult following.
And perhaps
which it
has. I would argue it's a little too generic to develop a cult following. It doesn't fit my criteria of being this really weird thing out of nowhere. It does kind of hit a lot of the action movie beats in a very familiar way.
But there wouldn't be a whole book defending it.
Exactly.
Yeah. And I want to distinguish between two things. One of which is what Steven is talking about when he talks about defenders of movies while they're out. Mm-hmm. Like the way Matt Seitz is about Lone Ranger. That's not a revisiting. That's how he felt when he saw it from the beginning. And that's sort of what we're doing a little bit with Edge of Tomorrow. That even if it's not going to make money and people are going to say, now, granted, it's gotten
much better reviews. More.
But this is we should say this is something that happens particularly with science fiction movies, too. Like Blade Runner was considered a flop initially, 2001.
This thing is going to have legs. That's a good movie.
And I think very often there's a difference between that, which is the dissenting critic at the time, like Matt was with Lone Ranger. And then what Steven is talking about is also that cycle of revisiting, where I think is that often is coming from a place where at the time a movie comes out, there is often, unless it gets great reviews and flops commercially, if it gets reviews and flops commercially, there is no distinction made between the art and the commercial accomplishment. Mm-hmm. It's sort of like this thing, this just sucked. And it was roundly rejected by the public. And rightly so, and whatever. And so what you get is that cycle of people coming back later and wanting to distinguish as they do with John Carter, and as they do, I think, with Hudson Hawk in some cases, and saying, okay, here's the flaws, here's the problem, here's where it got away from them. But here is where, logically, as you would assume when there are a lot of creative people involved... And these pieces exist about Cloud Atlas, saying...
That movie has staunch defenders.
And defenders at the time, but also revisitors, people who come back around and say, look, now that we've left the vulture-laden cycle of when a movie comes out and we decide good or bad.
Mm-hmm. Well, and when all the stories are about how much money the studio had to write down.
Exactly. Well, and often, you don't really know that until you know what happened on DVD and you don't know what happened in foreign. Like, you really can't tell what's going to happen with Edge of Tomorrow yet in foreign markets. And
I just spent $4 watching John Carter.
It's true. It could turn around. But you get those revisitings that I think are partly about people wanting to distinguish between it was not commercially successful and it was not good. Because those are very different things, obviously.
Yep.
And I should say, too, one of the things I thought about during Edge of Tomorrow was it is really hard to market movies based on execution.
Yeah.
It is so much easier to market movies based on what kind of movie it is. Mm-hmm. And if you can successfully convince people it's this kind of movie and then people go for that reason and it's good, then you get word of mouth and so forth. But for a big opening weekend, it needs to not be a movie that's all in the execution. And this movie, because people have seen spacesuits and fighting suits before, they've seen time travel before.
You had a big Tom Cruise similarly plotted movie a year ago. Not similarly plotted, structure-wise.
Seen Tom Cruise before. They've seen fighting aliens before. It's all in the execution.
It's this also movie called Edge of Tomorrow, which is such a bad title.
That is a really bad title.
It combines The Edge of Night with A Search for Tomorrow.
It was our
is two soap operas.
I kept calling it On the Precipice of the Morrow.
There you go.
I kept calling it Day After Tomorrow, which a different movie and B got the Tom Waits song stuck in my head.
Yeah, I think it was a person we on the podcast like, Dave Holmes, who tweeted, Edge of Tomorrow sounds like a soap opera that a character on Mama's Family would watch.
Yeah, okay, so let's,
That is great.
So
that
let's
is
bring
so
this back.
Evocative.
Glenn, what is wrong with All You Need Is Kill?
It's just...
Other than syntactically being...
There's that.
Dysfunctional.
But it comes from a different language.
It's easier to remember than
sure
Edge
is.
Of Tomorrow.
It sure is.
No, it just sounds so dumb.
Yeah, it's true, but so does Edge of Tomorrow.
There is that.
Well, come and find us on Facebook, find us on the blog, tell us how you feel about Noble Failures. You know, no jokes, please. show-wise, us-wise. Mm-hmm. Come and find us and tell us what you think about Noble Failures, and I'm sure return to this topic in the future. And that brings us to our final segment, What is Making Us Happy This Week? Stephen Thompson, what is making you happy this week?
Just in general, the fact that early in the summer, I mean, you usually have like one or two big movies or whatever, and then there's not a lot to to talk about. The fact that there was just a crazy amount of things to choose from for our little show this week. We could have talked about the second season of Orange is the New Black that I haven't even dipped a toe into yet. We could have talked more about the Tony Awards, though I wouldn't have had anything to say.
Yep.
We could have talked about The Fault in Our Stars, mm-hmm. big, important, you know, movie that everyone's talking about. The fact that Bill Watterson mm-hmm. of Calvin and Hobbes returned to cartooning to do several installments of Pearls Before Swine. All of a sudden, for the first time in nearly 20 years, there are new Bill Watterson strips. It just felt like all weekend long, like just new pop culture was just interesting. Popular culture was being sprinkled on us from the heavens. So it was just a good, all around weekend of exciting things to talk about. Also, I got confirmation that, like our pal Glenn Weldon, I am going to Comic-Con.
All right.
Oh, heavens.
That'll
be great. We'll have more on that later, I'm sure. Glenn Weldon, what is making you happy this week?
A couple things. Just today, we find out that Inside Amy Schumer has been renewed for another season, third season, and Review, a show I loved and talked about quite a lot on Comedy Central, has renewed for a second season.
So. Oh, and King of the Nerds, definitely renewed.
Definitely renewed. Excellent.
Yes.
Great. But the main thing is Saved You a Click. It is a Twitter account that does exactly what it promises to do. So we live in a world where a bunch of outlets like Upworthy, Slate, Drudge, Mashable all try to get you to click on their thing by asking a question or being kind of coy. And every time you do, you feel terrible about yourself. You feel like, they got me. So what Saved You a Click does is it simply reproduces the clickbait and then gives you the answer in the same tweet, so that therefore you never have to go anywhere. And the more you read of these, the more you get the sense that the person writing Saved You a Click has a sort of flat, affectless voice. I imagine Selma from The Simpsons.
Yeah, me too.
Selma and or Patty. It would be like, so Esquire did one summertime tip that will save your feet and shoes. Wear really short socks. Slate did, forget the SAT, forget the GPA, just write four real good papers and this college will let you in. Bard. But it also sometimes provides context. Like, this was, I think, Elle magazine. Amazing news for your Diet Coke addiction. Study found it helps lose weight. Funded by the American Beverage Association. Really good.
So you really don't have to read it.
You don't. You don't mm-hmm. have to do anything. You can just sit there and not even lift a mouse to click. So that Saved You a Click on Twitter.
I like it. Thank you, Glenn Weldon. Chris Klimek, what is making you happy this week, sir?
What's making me happy this week is Miracle Man is back in print. This was a seminal revisionist Alan Moore superhero comic from the early 80s that ceased because of the publisher going bankrupt, and then another publisher picked it up, and then Neil Gaiman ended up continuing the series and doing this storyline that he didn't get to finish either. This is in the early 90s about the sort of fascist utopia that results from having an all-powerful, godlike Superman type fixing all the problems in the world, and there's no conflict, there's no war, there's no hatred, and what's left? He never got to finish the story. This was tied up in litigation for decades with because the character was originally called Marvel Man, Marvel Comics, which had nothing to do with this, tried to, you know, keep it out of print and stuff. But now Marvel has bought the rights. They are republishing the series from the beginning. In 2016, new issues written by Neil Gaiman will appear, concluding the story, and I'm very much looking forward to reading those. But the first reprints of the original stuff, which I, you know, hunted down individually, back issue by back issue, uh-huh. in the early 90s, have started to come out, and that's what's making me happy this week.
Wonderful. I have a couple things. First of all, I received my first ever promotional ukulele in the mail. Thank you, IFC.
what was compact. It promoting?
The new Garfunkel and Oates show.
Oh, good. Okay.
So the promotional ukulele
promoting something good.
Yeah, so the promotional ukulele has officially worked. Thanks for the promotional ukulele. Okay, so that's A. B is this weekend on Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me. Not only was the super fantastic Tim Gunn on the show, but they gave a little shout out to one of my favorite people on the planet, my dear pal and coworker, Beth Novi, who wrote the wonderful piece we had on the blog about Lady Hurricanes needing
so
to lean
good.
In. And hearing Bill Curtis intone Beth's writing, a piece of Beth's writing, because they used it in Who's Bill This Time?
You're going to let a glass ceiling hold you back? A glass ceiling? You're a hurricane, for crying out loud. Just shatter it.
Oh my gosh, it was so fun. It was so fun to read and to hear. And it was so fun to hear him, to hear Peter say our own Beth. No, because Beth, you'll hear Beth's name at the end of Wait, Wait every week because she's the web guru. Mm-hmm. They say web guru Beth Novi. But here was her actual material on the show. And it made me so happy because she's so awesome and funny. And so I was very happy for Beth. And then I have to be totally perfectly honest. The real thing making me happy this week, I have been for some reason, and Stephen and I have talked about this before, mainlining episodes of Hell's Kitchen. I'm not proud of this. But this is actually what I have been doing with a lot of my free time. And as I said on Twitter, the reason why you watch Hell's Kitchen is to get to the moment when Gordon Ramsay says, that lamb chop looks like Steven Tyler's earlobe. That is funny. It is similar to the thing that I think Steven has quoted in the past about the thing that looked like Gandhi's flip-flop. Yeah. I don't know. You watch a lot of Hell's Kitchen to get to those moments, but they are really funny. A lot of times he just says dog's dinner and it's very generic, but then he says that lamb chop looks like Steven Tyler's earlobe.
Yeah, it goes the extra mile. Good
for him. It's really funny. Yeah. It's really funny. And those are the things that are making me happy this week, all of those things. And that brings us to the end of our show. You can follow all of us on Twitter. You can follow me at NPR Monkey C. You can follow Stephen at I Dislike Stephen, STEPHEN. You can follow Glenn at GH Weldon, WELDO. You can follow Chris at CT Klimek, CTKLIMEK. You can follow our producer Jessica Reedy at Jessica _ Reedy. That's REEDY. And our producer Lauren Migaki at L Migaki, MIGAKI. And as always, you can follow our esteemed producer emeritus and music director Mike Katziff at Mike Katziff, KATZIF. Mike's band, Hello Come In, provides our in and out music, which you are tapping your foot to right now. So thanks to all of you for being here.
Thank you.
And thanks to all of you for listening, and we will see you back here next week. Thanks for listening to Pop Culture Happy Hour. If you are looking for something new to listen to, there are lots of other NPR podcasts, including great interviews, highlights from the week's news, storytelling, and entertainment. Browse them all on iTunes under Podcasts.